probably going to evolve. So we'll add a few more problems to it probably today.
Is that you and me that have seen it so far?
Huh?
I haven't had it out yet. So.
Oh, okay. Yes. Just here it is. Anyway, I just want to underscore. One of the great accomplishments of the standard model is that it's a fairly simple theory that has the ability to encompass a phenomenal wealth of data. Okay, now that's easy to say, and everybody says it. This is canonically what you're told when you start learning particle theory. But one of the things we'd like to do just in the first couple of days of this course is to drive that point home by just refreshing all of your memories about how you can just go through any of these PDG tables, the particle data group tables, look at lifetimes, selection rules for reactions, and most of that structure you can derive in two liners to get the order of magnitude. All right, following very, very simple rules. So we don't want to just make it a word story. We want to make sure that you can actually do it. It's not hard. There's another thing. There's another sort of point to the first couple of lectures here. So normally, when you're introduced to the standard model, you're given the theory, and then you work out the consequences. And you work out the meson and hadron spectroscopy, and you work out lifetimes, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the situation that we're in right now in particle theory is that we may start seeing things at the LHC, new excitations, new particles, new patterns of decay. We don't have the theory. So the mindset that I think it's important to get yourself into is imagine that you're seeing fundamental excitations and basically you should learn how to ask questions that can give you a hint for what the underlying theory is. Okay? So how do you organize new fundamental excitations into multiplets to see if there's some sort of underlying symmetry? And how do you test different hypotheses for what that underlying symmetry is? Okay? Now, the development of the standard model, of course, is full of fascinating examples of doing this. So I think everybody here has seen the standard model, but I'm still going to spend one more lecture going through examples of how things like isospin and today strangeness as another quantum number that you see in low-energy phenomenology, how those show up and how you even figure out what all of the quantum number assignments are. Okay. So I think a lot of it's fairly simple, but when we actually start seeing things at the LHC, you should be in a frame of mind that we're going to have to figure out what all the quantum number assignments are, what the fundamental symmetries are, not that we're going to have them from the get-go. We have ideas about what we might find, but many of us think the most likely outcome of the next few years is that we find a theory that we haven't thought of yet, principally because the theories we have, they don't work so well to actually explain phenomenology at the weak scale in a natural way. But we'll get to that a little later. Okay. My comment about they don't work so well, or... supersymmetry has some pretty serious issues with low energy phenomenology, and I mean it can still work, it can still provide a solution to the hierarchy problem, but in detail, if you crack it open and you look at it, it kind of sucks. But we'll get there, and you can decide for yourself. All right. Okay. So tomorrow we'll try to start collider physics and from a more modern point of view. So I'll try to finish this up today. I think last time we left off with the parametrics of weak decay and the weak interactions. So let me go back to that. There were some questions. I think there was one question about phase space. And there was this other question about the massive hierarchy between the neutron decay or the beta decay reaction and, say, the lifetime of the muon or the lifetime of the pion, right? Those are many orders of magnitude separated. And yet we want to attribute them to the same force. So can we actually account for that? Okay. So let's go ahead and start. Let's see. I think all of you, I had a table up here before with a bunch of information on it. I'm not going to write that down again. I'll just assume that you remember what I had up here. See if I remember what I had up here. Okay. So one thing that's worth trying to account for. So on the one hand, you have something like a muon. Decaying with a lifetime of order, I'm just gonna drop the prefactor, 10 to the minus 6 seconds. On the other hand, you have something like a neutron, which we all ascribe it to the same process, going to proton, electron, antineutrino. And this has a lifetime of, say, 900 seconds, very roughly. Okay? So how do you account for that big difference? So we motivated from the structure of this interaction and the fact that there is baryon and lepton number something of the form, call it weak interactions, which goes like this constant called G Fermi times a current-current coupling. So this is the leptonic part. This is the baryonic part. There's an appropriate generalization to include the mesons as well on the hadronic side. All right, now let me just give you the answer for the muon. If you just take, so you've probably done some of these calculations before, but you'll get a quick refresher, I think, in tutorial. We have some calculations using this effective interaction spelled out in more detail. But for something like the muon, parametrically, okay, you could guess the answer. It's pretty easy. The width goes like G Fermi squared. Right, just because the amplitude from the Hamiltonian is going to have one factor G Fermi, you square it. And then it goes like the muon mass to the fifth. And then there's this enormous phase space factor that you have to keep track of. In this case, it's 192 pi cubed. So this is an enormous order one number that you have to keep track of that comes from phase space. So this is actually the answer for the muon lifetime. And this actually gets you the right scale. Okay? Just taking a current-current interaction, compute the amplitude, and this will fall out. So that gives you something like 10 to the minus 6 seconds. How do you get 900 seconds? Okay, I alluded to that at the end of the last lecture. It has something to do with phase space and squeezing the phase space. So just to sort of give you an idea of how you would quickly spell that out, all right, if you have a process. Okay, how should I draw it? I'll draw it suggestively like so. Okay, I'll say it's neutron, proton, electron, antineutrino. Okay. So the width times the mass, schematically, it goes like an integral over all the final particle phase spaces. Okay. So these are d3p's over twice the energies, which I'll just refer to as masses, but this is, let me just spell this out. So this is the energy of the proton, 3p, d3pe, or 2ee, d3p nu, 2e nu. And there's a delta function. So proton plus electron plus neutrino. Minus the neutron, okay, and then at the end there's the matrix element squared, okay. So there's the actual matrix element to the process, and then you have to do an integral over phase space, okay. So let's do some dimension counting. All right, does this actually work? You get mass dimension 2 from each of these phase space integrals. Minus 4 from the delta function. Okay, and that matches 2 over here, okay. So just doing this integral quickly, let's just go through this just to keep track, because this is what we want to explain. We want to explain why this one's so large. All right, first of all, note that when you integrate over phase space, over the entire allowed region, just because there's not much energy difference between the initial and the final, this proton will never be relativistic. So at a good approximation, its energy is just its mass, okay? So I'm going to go ahead and just write down the approximations in the, on this on a lower line. Okay, so we'd have, you know, d3p for two mass of the proton. All right, to a good approximation, well, this is not a good approximation, but for illustration, I'm going to pretend like the electron is massless. Okay, so let's just forget about the masses of the electron and the neutrino. It's good for the neutrino. In this case, not so good for the electron, but it simplifies the math. Okay, so for these, I'm going to just call this PEP nu. Okay. Okay. And then note that, so we already set this close to the proton mass. And then let's use the part of the delta function here to just integrate over. So there's still a delta function here. Just fill that back in here, times the matrix element squared. Use the delta function to take care of the proton integral. All right? So this, just go like, now I'm going to start dropping my factors of 2, okay? So this turns into just a two-body phase space integral now. Okay, and then there's just the energy conservation. Okay, so here's the small mass difference that you see in the delta function. So you see the final state energies are constrained times the matrix element squared. Okay. So after a little bit of manipulation, I will not spell out the remaining integrations here. Let's just assume that the matrix element squared while integrating over this phase space, this rather small amount of phase space, is basically constant. We can just pull it out front. Okay, so that's what I'm going to do. I'm dropping even more factors of 2, but this very roughly turns into an integral over the small phase space given by the neutron-proton mass difference of PE, the electron energy, times delta M minus PE. This is using the delta function, dPE. So I'm just using the energy delta function to integrate over the neutrino. Okay, and this schematically goes like the matrix element squared times this delta M cubed over the proton mass. Okay? So what I'm trying to highlight here, just doing some quick phase space numerology, is you get a phase space factor in the limit that you squeeze the phase space out of delta M cubed. Okay? So of course that's much, much, much smaller than the phase space that was available in the muon. Now, if you stopped here and you just said, well, okay, the matrix element should be dimensionless. So what are some good, what would you expect for the actual matrix element squared part of this, the amplitude squared? I mean, you certainly expect, a G Fermi squared, right? It's just coming from this interaction. I drew the diagram here. So one possibility is that this could just be the mass of the neutron to the fourth. Okay? Does anybody think that's actually how it works out? So you'll calculate these. The one thing you need to sort of just refresh your memory on is how to figure out what the scalings of matrix elements are. Okay? Because there's a couple of possibilities, and it fundamentally depends on whether the couplings here are between vector currents or axial currents. Okay? So parity actually matters. For a vector current, though, you get all of these matrix elements end up being of the form where you have, I'll just say the words and you go over it tutorial. You get a tensor for the neutron-proton piece that depends on momenta. And then you get a tensor that depends on the electron-neutrino piece. Okay, so these are Lorentz indices contracted that depends on the momenta. All right, this this is for a vector interaction. This term will give you the only thing it can. It'll give you the mass scales of the neutron proton. So this term will give you 2 powers of the nucleon of the proton or neutron mass. And this will give you the only thing it can in the massless limit. It either gives you something that's zero in the massless limit, which can happen if you have like axial current interactions. But in this case, it's a vector current. You'll get delta m squared. Okay. So actually, these matrix elements all go like G Fermi squared times the mass of the proton squared times delta m squared. Okay. This is all. You guys can keep track of the factors of two if you'd like in tutorial, but this is just to illustrate power counting. So if you combine all of these factors, all right, I have the matrix element squared goes like that, gamma m goes like that. This ends up working out to be G Fermi squared delta m to the fifth times mass. Okay. All right, that's a bit of a mess on the board, so let me erase a bit. Or just summarize. So then we get a width for neutron going to proton E nu that schematically goes like G Fermi squared delta m to the fifth. Okay. So that's how we get this enormous hierarchy between a process like beta decay in neutrons and muons. Analogous things happen with other mesons and hadrons. So this is all to say that when you're looking at decay lifetimes for a theory like QCD, where you have accidents that happen, where occasionally the initial and final state are much closer than the natural mass scale of the problem, you've got to keep track of phase space. So this is fundamentally what gives you that long lifetime. Okay. Now, what about something like charged pion decay? Do you know how that works? How would you estimate the lifetime for charged pion decay? Is it like with the muon? Is it G Fermi squared times m pi to the fifth? Is that the answer? So let's think about the width m pi plus goes to plus minus mu. Okay, there's certainly a phase space factor, for sure. Okay, now this one actually turns out to be kind of interesting. And you need to know a little bit about effective field theory to calculate this one. Okay, why? I mean, you'd worry you're starting with a particle that interacts strongly. So you might wonder, well, okay, do the strong interactions affect your ability to actually calculate this perturbatively? And no, there's a nice way of organizing the calculation so that you can parameterize the strong interactions. So this is one of the things we want to discuss, either probably not today, but there's a tutorial on Thursday, right? So we'll make sure that there's a refresher on using effective field theories in appropriate situations. The answer here actually turns out to be a little bit subtle. You expect the G Fermi squared, right? But you've probably seen the pion decay constant. Okay, and this is a bit, well, let's see. Okay, schematically it's this. I'm dropping a few terms. I'm not going to worry too much about the 4 pi. So this is not as simple as the muon, nor is it as simple as the neutron. Okay, but all of the decays of mesons have this character. So I think I'm going to spare you the details of this calculation in lecture, and let's make sure we do this in tutorial. Okay, because this structure, you can rescale and get good estimates on practically all of the meson decay lifetimes that are weak decays. up to some additional things you can need to keep track of. All right, let's move on. Okay, so far everything looks like it might be consistent with one new force responsible for the decay. But now, and what I promised last time is that things get a little more interesting with a whole new batch of excitations that kick in. Okay, so to mass it around, now I'm not gonna draw tables in as much detail as I did last time. You can look in the PDG, but you should know roughly what these things are. So there's a mass at around, at a mass at around 500 MeV, you start to see another collection of excitations. So I'm just going to call them K plus, K minus, K zero bar. Okay. So there's this family of states. Okay, and here's a few features about them. So for example, now they're all heavier than the pions. They're lighter though than the neutrons and protons. So that's one obvious question that you'd want some answer to. So does anybody know why they're kind of in the middle yet? Okay, we'll get there. All right, so the K plus, K minuses, they decay most of the time to mu plus, mu minus neutrino. They also decay to pi plus, pi minus, pi zero. These are the leading decays. I'm only going to list the decays sort of above 10-ish percent. So this one is basically, 64%. This one is 21%. Okay. The lifetime. Let's see. The lifetime for these decays. It's about 10 to the minus 8 seconds. Okay. And on the other hand, K0, well, these guys are interesting. So actually, there seems to be two ways of grouping these. They don't show up. I'm gonna not call them K0s. I'm going to call them K-short and K-long. Okay. So there's a K-short that's close in mass that decays to basically pi plus, pi minus. And it decays to pi naught, pi naught. Okay? And this, we call it K short. It has a relatively short lifetime of about 10 to the minus 10 seconds. And then there's K long, which decays to 3 pions. There's actually a bunch of decays for these, but it's mainly the 3 pions, and then the other ones are pions with electrons. This one's about 69%. This one's about 31%. Okay. And the lifetime for K long is about 2 orders of magnitude longer. So it's about 5 times 10 to the minus 8 seconds. Okay? So that's funny. So it would have been simple had these all had roughly the same lifetime, but nature wasn't so kind. It handed us a confusion already at this level. So these long lifetimes are already indicative of weak decay. But one question you might ask is, are they actually totally consistent with weak decay? I mean, if you actually take, for example, the parametrics that we use for a neutron decay and a muon decay, do you actually get the right answer? Or is it off by some amount? Okay. It turns out to be off by some amount. All right. These are actually a little longer lived. All of these are a little longer lived than you would have naively guessed, by about an order of magnitude. Okay. Now you should be able. I'm going to leave it as an exercise. Just take what you know about the pion lifetime scaling, that, and try to apply it to something like charged kaons, and see if you get the right answer. See if it's off. Okay, and I'll just tell you right now, what you're seeing evidence for is that this is known as Kibibo suppression. Okay, we'll talk about that later if you don't know what it is. If you know what it is, this is where you first see it. Okay, there's more though. There's another set of interesting excitations. I'm going to erase this now. So up at around 1100 MeV, so this is now a little bit heavier than the neutron and proton, we have another family. So there's, I'll just list them. Okay, I'll start with these. There appear to be another group of four excitations. Actually, this one's a little different in mass than these three. These three are a little closer. Now, these are qualitatively different than these objects. Okay. And the main way in which they're different is, first of all, their lifetime's a little different, but they also decay into things like neutrons and protons. Okay. So, for example, the lambda hyperon, it decays mainly to proton pi minus and a neutron pi naught, and it has a lifetime of about 10 to the minus 10 seconds. Okay, so it's a little longer lived. Sigma plus goes to a proton, pi naught, neutron, and a pi plus. It has a lifetime of about 10 to the minus 10 seconds. Okay. Now, it would be nice if these simple patterns held all the time, but you know, here's an exception. What's up with this one? It's actually not decaying to neutrons and protons. It goes down to this object plus a photon pretty much all the time. And this one is super fast. This lifetime is like 10 to the minus 20 seconds. Okay? So they're not all decaying the same way. There's something slightly interesting happening here. And this one goes to, the negative object goes to neutron pi minus most of the time with a lifetime of about 10 to the minus 10 seconds. Okay. All right. So there's another odd characteristic about all of these objects. All right. There seems to be two families based on the way they decay. But these are only ever produced in pairs. That's the other odd feature about them. Okay. So, for example, when you scatter, this is something that we can do. We can take pions and protons and neutrons in the laboratory and scatter them and make these objects. So you scatter, what this is going to mean is one of neutron, proton, pion plus one of neutron, proton, pion. And what you find is they go to qualitatively pairs of these new states. So pairs of k plus, k minus, k0, k0 bar. Or in some cases, pairs that involve these objects. So let me spell that out in a little more detail. So for example, you see pi minus plus proton goes to lambda plus k0. You see pi plus pi minus plus a proton goes to the sigma plus minus plus k plus. On the other hand, when you just scatter a pion off another pion, you don't seem to see the sigmas or the lambdas. You only see the kaons. Okay? So we see these, and they're strong. Okay? So it's strong. So we immediately know all of these objects are strongly interacting just from their production rates and interaction cross-sections. That's easy. But what's explaining the presence of only pair production? Okay. Now, there's another important clue. It's not just what you see, it's also what you don't see. We don't see pions going to something like a lambda plus a kaon. And we also don't see, so I'm going to just mark these out, sigma plus minus plus kaons. So even though I said that they're produced in pairs, not all pairs are created. Okay? So we see these kinds of pairs. We don't see these kinds of pairs. All right. That's, I've now told you all the essentially important information about these objects. So now you should be able to tell me what kinds of quantum numbers might be at play here. What kinds of symmetries are there in the problem? All right, I just told you like 20 years of hard experimental work to acquire. So as theorists, you should be able to figure this out. Good. So the first thing you try to do is you know about other conserved quantum numbers in the pion, proton, neutron sector, right? We had strong evidence for something like baryon number, for lepton number. We had isospin. So the first question you'd ask is, how do those quantum numbers fit in? And it's exactly what you said. These reactions all have the property that there's, well, these two in particular have the property that there's a baryon in the initial state. These don't have baryons. Moreover, when you look at the decays of these objects have baryons in the final state. The decays of these objects do not have baryons in the final state. Okay, so this is certainly, you know, this is the natural starting point. You take the old quantum numbers that you had, and you see if there's a consistent assignment of those quantum numbers to these new excitations. Okay, now, of course, in this case, all of these are baryons, and we can give them baryon assignment 1 to account for this pattern. The absence, well, the presence of reactions like these means that our only options are either to assign this sort of baryon plus, you know, plus and minus 1, but that doesn't work because we don't see these. Okay. So the only good option is to assign the kaons baryon number 0. And that's also consistent with the decay patterns. So the consistent embedding, a baryon number tells you that the kaons are sort of physically like the pions. These are physically like the neutrons and protons. Okay, but what else? Does that explain why they're only produced in pairs? So why are they only produced in pairs? So we ran into a similar situation with baryon number back when we were trying to find evidence for a quantum number like baryon number.
Yes.
We also saw these sort of pair production selection rules. Well, you have to know about antiparticles to see that, but so do you want to introduce something like baryon number? What about a parity? Would a parity work? A parity would clearly help explain why they're produced in pairs, right? Like, so suppose all these objects carried a parity under which they have assignment minus 1, right? So they flip under the operation of the parity. So let's say the kaons and the sigmas and the lambda hyperons, they all had parity minus 1, and everything else had parity plus 1. So that would account for the pair production, right? So how would you actually test that? If you think there's a parity, what kinds of reactions would you look for that you think would be allowed or disallowed? I mean, how would you actually test the parity hypothesis? So in particular, what's a reaction that would be not allowed by a parity, naively, that you could look for? Okay, I mean, if you're going to assign parity minus 1 to all of these objects and you produce 3 of them, that would be a parity minus 1 state, right? So you could look for producing 3 of them. Yeah, so which set of 3 would you look at? Okay, well, maybe discuss this a little bit more in tutorial, because when we think about models of new physics beyond the standard model, this question, I mean, parity plays a pretty important role in a lot of our theories for a bunch of reasons. So think about this question experimentally. If you're going to introduce parity quantum numbers or additive quantum numbers, how do you separate those two? So you could try to produce three kaons, right? Okay, so that's close. So I strongly encourage you all to actually flesh that possibility out. See if you can like tighten the argument up and kill parity based on the three. I'm not going to tell you the answer though. I'm going to give you another hint from the data though that pretty strongly pushes us away from parity. Okay. But do think about it. Because you've probably heard terms like little Higgs theories, supersymmetry with R parity, all of these theories. They all have parities. Some of them, not many of them, have new additive quantum numbers, but it's important to be able to tell the difference. Especially with the LHC, we find something with, you know, quote unquote, missing energy. All right, this will be the leading question. Have we found a parity or have we found something else? Okay. So an important clue. You've all got this written down out of chalkboard space. So I'm going to have to erase something. I'll erase this. No, I won't. I'm going to erase. Okay. An important clue comes from the presence of two other excitations. There's two other excitations which really push you away from thinking in terms of parity. Okay. So up at around a mass of 1300 MeV, these are Xi's, how I say them? Xi's. Somebody know how to properly pronounce them? Okay. So two new states, and we see them in reactions that involve protons and neutrons. Okay. And here's what's kind of interesting. They're produced in association with kaons. Okay? So, if you were to imagine that you've got a parity at work, then the fact that, so this is a strong process. Okay, so millivarnish rates. If you were to imagine that you have a parity at work, so that, say, the kaons carry the minus one parity, that was the sort of hypothesis that you'd have for explaining pair production, you would have assigned parity plus one to these new objects. Okay. But if those are going to have parity plus one, then you would wonder why they don't just decay, say, to something like neutrons, protons, plus pions quickly. Okay. Because that parity wouldn't be protecting their lifetime. Also, you'd wonder, so here's another piece of it. In fact, the leading decay, one of the leading decays for these objects, goes into lambda plus pi minus. So this is a decay. And it appears to be a weak decay because the lifetime's quite long. Okay, so this is the decay. I'm going to call it a weak decay. But really, the biggest clue is, you know, if it's parity even, then why is it not decaying quickly to other parity even objects? That's one question you would ask about this hypothesis. So I don't need to write it up there, but I mean I'm thinking concretely in terms of like instead of this object, say a neutron and a pion. So why is it doing this instead of going into a neutron plus a pion? Okay. Now there is an easy way to explain that if what's actually happening here is there's an additive quantum number, something like charge. So instead of a parity, there's actually a charge quantum number involved. Okay. Now, so how would you account for this? You would say that, you know, these objects, they can carry, you can account for all this data, all the pair production data, by assigning these objects charge plus or minus 1. Right? So normalize to the charge of one of them, and the other would have integral, say, integral units relative to one of them. So for example, if the lambda and k0 have the same charge, you would say this final state is a plus 2, and this is a 0. So this would violate that charge. Likewise for all the others. These would be allowed by that charge, but there's already something like baryon number to prevent those. Okay, so that's consistent. And you can account for the fact that you've got strong reactions here by taking this to have 2 units of that charge, right? So a simple Z2 parity didn't work, but an additive quantum number can account for the data. Okay. That would also help explain why this decay, for example, isn't fast. It would also explain why these don't decay into neutrons plus pions quickly, right? Because this now violates that charge. Okay, so this is a little fast. Now, in fact, what you need to do, I mean, if you want to be careful about this, there's other kinds of parities, right? You could think of instead of like a Z2 parity, you could think of a Z3 parity or a Z4 parity. Maybe they don't change sign. Maybe they pick up a phase, and there's a symmetry under that. You should think about those options. Maybe I was being glib with charge assignments. Maybe, you know, I shouldn't think in terms of integral units. I should think in terms of something else. So I encourage you also in the tutorial to think about how this information could be pieced together from some other hypothesis. But for now, we're going to introduce a new quantum number, and this was dubbed strangeness, which is how you know it's associated. Well, I won't make comments, but. Okay, so let me just tell you in summary form what charge assignments work. So if we give, all right, is all this written down? I'm going to erase this side. Okay, now all of this is stuff you've seen in the Standard Model course, right? You were told there's a quantum number called strangeness. You can derive it from symmetries using the three-flavor quark model. Okay, you know from on high that this is true. Okay, but you know if you're not given the theory a priori, how do you figure that these things are, you know, that these new symmetries are present in nature? So you should definitely be putting your putting yourself in that frame of mind to understand LHC data. Okay. So the lambdas can be given charge minus 1. In fact, we can just normalize relative to those. And we will put the, let's put the, in fact, all the sigma plus, sigma minus, sigma 0 to s equals minus 1. Let's put the kaons can be accounted for. All right. Now this may seem like a, you know, I'm just pulling this out of thin air. I encourage you to try other charge assignments. And these objects, remember we had the important clue that they appear to be produced in association with other pairs of kaons. So these are not produced in pairs. They're actually produced with pairs of kaons. These are given charge minus 2. Okay, and that accounts for the data. Now, what other quantum numbers did we learn about from pion, proton, neutron scattering? There was another symmetry that the strong interactions preserved. So more than just baryon number and lepton number, there was also isospin. Right? There was this SU2 symmetry that the pions, protons, and the neutrons appeared to obey, approximately. Can we derive what the isospin assignments should be from some of these reactions that I wrote down? Now that I erased, but okay, I'll write one of them. Yeah. So, for example, one of the reactions I told you about was this reaction. This was, in fact, how we produce these new objects. They're produced in pairs. So, for example, with this reaction, can you assign isospin to these new states such that the strong interactions would appear to preserve this isospin symmetry? Are these all isospin singlets? Are they not charged under isospin, or are they charged under isospin? That's the first question, sort of up or down. Okay. And it's sort of clear, right? I mean, there's no isospin singlet channel here, right? Because remember, this was an isospin 1 object, this was an isospin 1/2 object. So there's no isospin singlet channel. There's no isospin 0 channel, just from the rules of addition of angular momentum. Okay, so one of these has got to carry isospin for isospin to be preserved. Now, let's start with this object, because this object, and I'm setting aside a sort of interesting historical story here. People for a long while thought that this might be charged under isospin, and remember, objects that are charged under isospin usually occur in pairs with charged particles, with electromagnetically charged particles. Remember this formula that appeared to do a nice job of explaining the data, this relationship between isospin and baryon number? Right? So if you got something that carries baryon number, like the lambdas, if it carries isospin, you would expect it to have a charged partner. Okay? But it doesn't seem to actually have a charged partner. People for a while tried to assign one of the sigmas to be its charged partner. It didn't work. It's a little too split in mass. It doesn't quite look like it wants to be partnered up with it. So the fact that the lambda hyperon doesn't have a charged partner is pretty strong evidence that, so let's see, how do I want to write this? So lambda has no charged partner, and I should really say no electromagnetically charged partner. So this seems to suggest that the isospin of the hyperon is 0, okay? So there we go. So you said one of these should have isospin. It's not the lambda. It's the kaon. So what isospin should it have? So let's break this reaction down a little bit. So let me just list the isospin 3 numbers. The pi minus had -1. The proton had +1/2. This is going to 0. Right? If we want to try to assign isospin such that it's a symmetry of the problem, this would be one's first guess. Okay? So you'd say this is isospin, has an I3 of -1/2. That means it either lives in a doublet or it lives in an isospin 3/2 multiplet. So there's two options that are sort of natural. Now there's actually four kaons. So actually, this possibility that all four of them live in a multiplet with I equals 3/2 is kind of interesting. That'd be nice. So tell me why that can't work. Okay, tutorial. Figure out why these are not in an I equals 3/2 case. Okay, the simplest possibility is that the kaons are two doublets of isospin. Okay? And all those reactions I wrote up earlier for the pair production, just stare at the isospins of the incoming states, and you'll see why these can't be isospin 3/2. Okay? Okay, so the K0, so K0 and K plus, again, remember if something has isospin, it should have electromagnetically charged partners. So the partner for the K0 is a K plus. If this has -1/2, its partner would have +1/2, and that would make it charged +1. So this is a doublet. Okay, so these are the I equals 1/2 multiplets, right? And they have I3 equals ±1/2. All right. So we figured out what the kaon isospin it can be to consist for the strong interactions to consistently preserve isospin. One other I'll mention. I'll just write the reaction down and I'll spare you the logic for a second. Go back to this reaction. This is one of the others I wrote up there before, so I shouldn't have erased all of those. But now once you know the isospin of the kaon, you can pretty easily figure out what the isospin of the sigma should be. Okay, this is an isospin 1 object. This is an isospin 1/2 object. That's an isospin 1/2 object. So this is an isospin what? 1, right. Okay. So the sigmas live in a triplet. And they're all very close in mass. So it's actually quite nice that that works. It's consistent with the fact that they're not split by a huge amount. They appear to be grouped together. Okay. Now, all these lifetimes were sort of between 10 to the minus 8 and 10 to the minus 10 seconds. So I encourage you to figure out why, what the origin of the 10 to the minus 10 is, as opposed to the 10 to the minus 6, 10 to the minus 8. Is that just a question of phase space? Okay. What's one of the odd ones up here? This one. So why is this so fast? Okay, first of all, it's going from a sigma 0 to a lambda plus a gamma. Now, based on our strangeness assignments, did this preserve or violate strangeness? Yeah. Okay. So what kind of decay do you think this one is? So is it consistent with strong decay? So strong decay would have actually been what time scale? Strong decay for a GEV-ish state would have been what time scale? Yeah, so is this strong or is this something else? It's a little slow for strong, right? It's hard to tell. You know, it's only a few orders of magnitude. But actually, I should have told you the prefactor. Because the prefactor is 7, so that's more like 10 to the minus 19. So it's not just 3 orders of magnitude. It's more than that. Correction. Don't drop prefactors. Sorry, I should have just rounded this to the minus 19. Anyway, this seems to be roughly consistent with electromagnetic decay. It's got a photon in the final state, so that might be your naive guess, right? Just take the lifetime that you would have gotten from strong decay and tack on a factor of alpha over 4 pi, roughly. That gets you into the right ballpark, okay? To do the calculation correctly, again, requires use of effective field theory. But this appears to be electromagnetic decay. Now, that's interesting, because at least at this point, we don't have any evidence for electromagnetism. Well, let me just ask the question. We have strangeness, baryon number, and isospin, and we have electromagnetism as a force, and we have weak interactions. Now, the weak interactions appear to break isospin. We learned that before. They appear to violate strangeness. Okay, but what about electromagnetism? Does electromagnetism violate strangeness? Does it violate this new quantum number? No. Okay. So that's an important clue. It's important later on when figuring out how you fit together electromagnetism with the weak interactions. But at least at this level, you won't find any evidence for it, and that's essential to note. All right. So let me summarize here, because I think I want to just ramp this up. So weak in electromagnetism, they preserve charge, baryon number, lepton number. Weak interactions violate strangeness and isospin. Does electromagnetism violate isospin? Remember the pi zero decay? Okay. So electromagnetism does not respect isospin. That's actually set aside details. But it does appear to preserve strangeness. Okay. Now, there are splittings among these multiplets. I just want to point out one small thing. I'm sure you've seen this before. But I mean, if you look at say the charge partners versus the neutral in this multiplet, or you look at the charge partners versus the neutral ones in this multiplet, or the charge partners of the pions, there are little splittings, right? Okay. Now these are in isospin multiplets. What do you think accounts for the splitting in those multiplets? Why do you think the charge states are split from the neutral states? Okay, if this is simple, somebody should tell me.
Because
Is it the weak interactions that are splitting the masses? Is it electromagnetism? We think strong preserves isospin, so the only option, I mean, it's not gravity, so that sort of gives us electromagnetism as the main culprit. It could be the weak interactions, but if it's the weak interactions, you'd have to figure out how you start with this, with G Fermi, which is this tiny dimensionful number, and how you get MeV mass splitting. So somebody would have to write down a formula that even parametrically comes close to doing that. Okay, it does that. So electromagnetism is the main culprit, and after all, these are charged states, that's neutral. So you would naively guess this. And in fact, what would the naive estimate be for the mass correction? You would expect that, I mean, if you pile a bunch of charge into something of size L, you expect an alpha over L correction. I mean, basically it carries alpha over L in energy. Okay? So you expect that splittings between charge multiplets, if this is accounted for by electromagnetism, you expect splittings of order alpha over pi. I'm just going to call it order alpha over pi. Okay, so this means order alpha over pi. So 10 to the minus 3-ish. Take an electromagnetic. I mean, it's just the following classical picture, actually. Just take two charges and bring them to a region of size L, and the energy difference goes like 1 power of E squared. So it should be 1 power of alpha. There's a field theoretic way of just calculating this, but the classical picture suffices for getting an estimate. Okay, and in fact, if you look at all these splittings, they're consistent with this picture. Okay, they're all 10 to the minus 3-ish. Okay, so that's further evidence that electromagnetism does not respect isospin. If it did, you would have thought that all of these would be dead degenerate within the isospin multiplets. All right, now we have a new quantum number strangeness. So like before, when we had baryon number and isospin, we tried to relate all of the conserved quantum numbers, right? So you can do that here. And so when we introduce strangeness, if you want to relate all of the conserved quantum numbers with one another, I'm not going to derive this, but you can see that you can just check that it's true with the other charge assignments once they've been made. Okay. Now, eventually, the electroweak unified theory will tell us how this sort of thing comes about. Okay, where that, because again, we have a phenomenological formula that relates conserved quantum numbers. As a theorist, you know, you're compelled to figure out where this comes from. I mean, sort of a basic formula. There's got to be a deep reason. Okay. I think we're close to out of time, right? Yeah. Okay. So at the very beginning of, I think there's two other, I mean, Michael, I think, in his course went over the three quark constituent model. Okay, because I think And I might give you just a 5-minute refresher. I don't have more lessons from that. I mean, I think I can just tell you what the answer is. All of this structure is a reflection of there being three fermionic constituents, light quark constituents around, okay? And you can give these, I mean, because what I haven't done for you is I haven't grouped all of these excitations into bigger multiplets, okay? So I can refresh your memory about how these organize into bigger multiplets of SU3, all right? And now, why are they fermions and not scalar constituents? Great. But what's how do you know it's three constituents and not? I mean, what's a hint that there's three constituents then? I mean, one hint. I'll just tell you. I mean, because I didn't go over it, but there are these spin 3/2 baryons. There's this whole family of them. Okay. So that's a very strong hint. We don't see we see higher L excitations, but we don't see higher spin excitations. Right? So it seems to stop at 3/2. So that's already a hint, even if you didn't know anything about how the multiplets group up. Okay. But, you know, so maybe I'll spend 5 minutes just reminding you how you would guess SU3 as a constituent model. But the other, I think the other actually important lesson from the discovery and development of the standard model is charm, is the charm quark. Because meson and baryon spectroscopy does give you a lot of evidence for all of these, you know, baryon number, lepton number, strangeness, proximate isospin symmetry, which is broken by the weak interactions. We still don't have an explanation for that yet. See, what was I going to mention? Well, but the one thing that's missing from this picture, though, is once you postulate this quark model, you then want to ask, what does it actually predict? And one of the things that the constituent model with the weak interactions actually predicted in the early days was the presence of so-called flavor-changing neutral currents. Okay? Which, have you heard these terms? Flavor-changing neutral currents. So the standard model does not have these at tree level. But the three-flavor model predicts that it's there at tree level. Okay? And so then the question is, how in the heck do you resolve that? I mean, this was one of the reasons why the electroweak theory was sort of discounted in its early days, is that it predicted too large of a flavor-changing neutral reaction. That's how you would guess that there's actually a partner of the strange quark. You know, that the spectroscopy by itself didn't tell you that there was another quark, but the presence of rare processes that should be there from the low energy effective theory gave you a very strong hint that there was something else. So I do want to remind you of how that logic works, because it was used to actually predict the presence of the charm quark before it was discovered. Not only was the actual object predicted, but its mass was predicted, okay, to a good approximation. So that's just a lesson in, you know, good old-fashioned theoretical reasoning when combined with a little bit of data. Okay? But let's stop there for today. Are there any questions?